What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
So remember when it seemed like all of Wall Street firms and bigwigs in finance were all talking about fintech and innovation and disruption in the financial industry and paying up big time for fintech startups and the like? Well, they were, and then 2022 happened, which leads us to a Bloomberg Business Week story you can find online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and, of course, on the Bloomberg terminal.
Yeah, it's such an interesting story, Carol, and we are going to talk about it with Bloomberg News consumer finance reporter Paige Smith in our Bloomberg 99.1 studio in Washington, D.C. Paige, thank you so much for being here. I mean, fintech was like the cool guy, right? Can you start off by just setting the scene for us? How much love were these companies getting financially?
You're exactly right. Fintech was definitely the cool guy on the street. And I mean, the funding levels really reflected that. I mean, in 2019, I think the funding level reached almost $140 billion. And to put that into perspective, that was something like almost three times the level of funding in 2020. So just exorbitant amount of cash going towards these deals. And, you know, one analyst described it to me as sort of a balloon that just kept inflating but is now deflated. And I would say that it is certainly deflated at this point in time.
A deflator more than a pop, it sounds like. Paige, can you tell us what exactly happened there and what that big adjustment has looked like?
Definitely. So I think that at this point in time, we just have a number of big players who were operating in this space just admitting that they've sort of paid too much. So you have an insurance giant like Prudential sort of saying that they're switching gears and changing their strategies after acquiring the company Assurance IQ in 2019 for $2.35 billion. And, you know, I think part of this is just that a lot of that funding money dried up as a bear market took hold. And, you know, there are a number of other examples that kind of point to this, these sort of precipitous drop in valuations of fintech. You have, you know, sort of an outlier, but JP Morgan acquired the college planning website Frank for $175 million in 2021. And I mean, that has really turned out to be more than just a disappointing acquisition. The bank actually has gone as far to allege it was a victim of fraud. So wow. You just have sort of this, certainly a tide change. And I think just to kind of set the plate, though, and go back to where we were in 2021 and during the period of the pandemic, where there was just this frothiness of the market, you know, a lot of big banks and other Wall Street entities were really looking over their shoulder, sort of fearful that you would have this, you know, these fintech upstarts eating into their customer bases. And that's where a lot of this a lot of this came from. But again, as that analyst said, I think the balloon has certainly deflated, not popped, but definitely deflated.
So I want to go back to JP Morgan, Chase. I love your story. We love your story. And you talk about JP Morgan buying Frank, $170 million. And Jamie Dimon, who is never afraid to kind of say how he feels, has called that deal a huge mistake. So very clear about what he thought about it. That having said that, and I'm glad, Paige, that you brought up the pandemic, because to be fair, I'm wondering how the pandemic kind of distorted some of the gains and maybe ultimate losses when it comes to fintech, because it does feel like there was a fair amount of uptick, right? During the pandemic, these guys were on fire. We were all at home doing things, certainly everything and anything virtually, if you will, or online. So how did the pandemic kind of distort things and make money so cheap that you could kind of do anything with it?
I think you kind of hit on some of the primary points there, which is there were a lot of people staying at home. They had a lot of cash on hand, and they were sitting on their couches and online a lot more than they may be, you know, than you and I are today. So I think that really distorted things. And we've also seen that with other, you know, tech entities. You've seen Amazon and Netflix and Meta sort of have similar challenges. So I think there was definitely some distortion that happened. And, you know, while business is better now in some regards, and things have opened up, these investments maybe just didn't really live up to the sort of fervid expectations, I suppose, of both the acquirers and a number of investors in this space.
Well, and Paige, it makes me think about, okay, there was a pre-pandemic life, there was pandemic life with all of its, you know, distortions, the good and the bad, and then there's post-pandemic life, which we are still figuring out. So something like Stripe, right? Their volume growth is down substantially, but nonetheless, it's still a viable business. Is that a fair way to describe it or no?
Most definitely. And there was some news today, for example, about, you know, Goldman Sachs being involved in Stripe, involved with fundraising for Stripe in some regard. So I think that there are definitely, you know, I had one venture capital expert weigh in and kind of say, you know, don't discount fintech entirely yet. In fact, there actually might be some good deals to be had out there today. So it's not as if fintech is going away entirely. It's just that these sort of sky-high valuations maybe have sort of come down to earth a little bit.
Right. Like at the end of the story, you say it doesn't mean that fintech is over, according to one of your sources. Paige, help us be smarter about fintech heading into the rest of 2023. What does the outlook look like?
You know, again, that same expert actually said, like I mentioned, that it actually might be a good time for folks to look at fintech if you're sort of, if it matches up with your line of business and there's something that you sort of had your eye on and you're a Wall Street giant with, you know, some cash to burn, maybe a going after fintech right now might be a better opportunity. There might be a better opportunity to do that as opposed to during the pandemic and during 2021 when we saw that just exorbitant amount of funding going towards these fintechs. There might be better deals out there today.
Yeah, because no doubt about it, we're all increasingly doing everything, you know, online, cashless society. I don't know the last time that I've used cash. And like, so I just think, you know, the innovation disruption makes sense, but like, you know, very cheap money can make for some maybe not smart developments, if you will, in a space.
Exactly.
Paige, what a smart story. Paige Smith, thank you so much. Consumer finance reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us from our 99.1 studio in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
It's crazy to believe that we are nearing year three of life, year three when it comes to living with COVID-19, as some of us adapt to kind of getting back to normal here in the States. Other parts of the world, particularly China, are dealing with a renewed surge in cases. We are reminded that the virus still exists. This brings a lot of questions about where the pandemic stands and how the virus may mutate moving forward. We need to be thinking about this.
We do, and hopefully it doesn't get worse than it already has been these past couple of years. But here to discuss with us is Dr. Joshua Sharfstein. He is the Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, which of course is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. And Dr. Sharfstein is on the phone with us from Baltimore. Doctor, thank you so much for being here with us. I just want to get like an initial gut check from you on where we're at with the pandemic 3 years out. And should we feel as relaxed as I personally feel at this point? How are you feeling about it?
Well, I think we should feel that the worst of this pandemic has been absorbed by the country right now. And we are in a different phase where we have to find our way through the world with COVID, one of the hazards that's now in our lives. And so I think we're going back to maybe our usual way of being, but I think with a heightened awareness that there are dangers out there, and there are some new dangers, and every, you know, we will have new COVID variants. We will have to be dealing with them. We will have bad flu seasons, and we may even find ourselves with other new pathogens that we have to deal with.
So it sounds like there's some cautious optimism in that. But what one thing that does seem optimistic to me is that we're gearing up to end the public health emergency declaration. Can you tell me what that means and how you rate that?
Well, I think what that means is that the government is acknowledging that we really are in a new stage, that we don't have our hospitals crushed with patients with, you know, there for COVID like we did for a long time, that we do have great tools to take care of patients with COVID early, as well as the vaccine, which is extremely important. I'm actually a little nervous about the public health emergency ending, in part because what it just logistically means. It's got to happen, but we've got to do it well, because a lot of people, for example, who have gained Medicaid coverage, they may lose Medicaid coverage when the emergency ends, and we want to make sure that as many people who still qualify for that coverage keep it. That's going to be very important for them for every other part of their health.
Dr. Sharfstein, do we know how many people who are getting that as a result of the public health emergency declaration?
We don't know exactly, but there are like 90 million people in the Medicaid program now, which is a lot. It's higher than it's ever been. And in some places, it's estimated that, you know, a good, 10-20% of people could potentially lose coverage. Now, they may not qualify anymore. That's partly what's happening at the end of the pandemic. The era of automatically staying on Medicaid is going to end. But the challenge is that the process of rechecking everyone could let a lot of people fall through the cracks. That's one example of the danger that we have as we kind of negotiate the end of the pandemic. It's really important to try to fix things, make sure that people don't get unfairly hurt by this process. And I think it's part of the bigger picture of how we learn the lessons of COVID to strengthen our health overall.
Well, we know that people fall through the cracks in normal times, unfortunately. And in the pandemic, it was good to see the federal government and states and so on really kind of step up to pick up where people were left behind, if you will, when it comes to healthcare. Having said that, Dr. Sharfstein, I do wonder, it's funny, we've had this conversation kind of in-house. I still wear a mask when I get on the subway or I go into crowded spaces or sometimes even when I'm shopping or something. Do we know enough that if we start to see an uptick in cases or something starts to feel a little off, that we now have a playbook and know how to quickly kick into high gear?
Well, I think we do know a bunch of things that we can do. I think strategic mask wearing is one of those. Staying home when you're sick is extremely important. And then at the city level, at the county level, really keeping a close tabs on hospital capacity and how the healthcare system is doing is going to be extremely important. So we're better off in that regard. But we really shouldn't feel like we have to go back to the healthcare system, like you said, that has all these problems with it. You know, we should be trying to learn the lessons of COVID so that we can plug more of those gaps, and particularly with respect to public health, invest in the surveillance systems, invest in the staffing, so that when we need to scale back up again, and we push on the gas for that, you know, we move forward. We don't just sit there because we left the tank without any gas in it.
Well, Carol brings up the point of masking as a prevention method, but also getting the booster shot is so critical. And some studies show that only about 15% of the U.S. population has received an updated bivalent booster dose. I'm sure you have more updated numbers on that, doctor, but can you tell me to what extent the lack of booster shot getting is concerning to you?
Well, it's particularly a serious issue for older adults because there's no question immunity wanes, and there's no question that these new variants can get around the early immunity that people may have had. And so getting the booster shot is very important. I got the booster shot. I made sure my parents got the booster shot right away.
Yeah.
And I think this is a danger. Like, as the emergency ends from a legal perspective, that hasn't changed anything from the virus's perspective.
Right.
So we have to, remain as vigilant as possible, and keeping up with vaccines is just just absolutely critical. And, you know, again, we want to be able to keep up with this vaccine. We want to keep up with the flu vaccine. We want to make sure that there aren't gaps between groups of people so that there aren't inequities in access to vaccines. All those things are really important. And to do those things, we have to remember that we need a strong public health system instead of just looking forward and say, you know, COVID, we don't have to worry about it anymore.
So having said that, we still have to worry about COVID. Got to get our vaccines and all and the boosters and so on. But I am already thinking, I had a very dark dystopian conversation with a colleague here. And we just said, you know, at some point, Mother Earth is just saying enough. And either through cross-contamination, chemicals in our system, plastics in our system, what have you, all the things that people have been talking about, you do wonder what is the next virus or something that impacts, you know, the planet, akin to what happened with the Spanish flu that wipes out a massive amount of people. Is that something that is likely to happen? What is on the radar at Johns Hopkins when it comes to this?
Well, at Johns Hopkins, we are absolutely thinking about many different terrible scenarios. You know, we are experiencing unprecedented temperature change on the globe, and that's causing all kinds of problems for humans and for animals. And then it's also putting animals and humans into closer contact, which creates the opportunity for more pandemics. And so you've got environmental challenges, you've got new infectious disease emergencies. They do, we have the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins that has identified a series of families of pathogens that could be the most likely candidates to be the next pandemic, the next big one. And there are proposals to prepare for them by preparing potential vaccines in advance and doing extra research in these most likely to become a pandemic pathogen, doing that in advance. And those kinds of investments are important. I think I would say they're not enough. It's also important to remember that we had a great vaccine very, very quickly.
We've been here before, right? Ahead of COVID.
We have to be able to deliver the vaccine. So we have to be thinking about how to have the best countermeasures, how to deliver them, how to have not just the thing to give out, but the roads to do it, the metaphorical roads to do it into communities that may be distrustful. And you really need a strong public health system to do that. So it's really important to be thinking about what actually will be the next pandemic and preparing, but also these universal protections.
All right. So appreciate the time that we've had with you. Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, he's Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, as you know, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies, joining us on the phone from Baltimore.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I did come across a research note that talked about online gambling in the betting market globally, the size and share to exceed $114 billion by 2028, growing at a compound annual growth rate of nearly 11%. So we've got a great guest to talk about it. He's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Charles Gillespie, is co-founder and CEO of the publicly traded small cap gambling.com group limited. They operate in US, Ireland, and Malta. They are across the globe. You might know some of their sites, including gambling.com, bookies.com, and rotowire.com. Again, like I said, he's in studio with Maddie and myself. How are you?
I'm very well. Happy to be here today.
Well, tell us a little bit about your business and the industry and what you're seeing in the last year or so.
Our business is doing very well, and the entire industry over the last several years has shifted its focus away from Europe, which is kind of the historical home of regulated gambling, toward the United States, as the U.S. has become the center of gravity in this global industry. And the growth has just been phenomenal.
You know, what's phenomenal? Give us an idea. Can you give us some ballparks?
Well, you've got, I think it's already up to something like $10 billion in the U.S. And if you look back 3, 4, 5 years, it was sub $1 billion.
But what kind of growth are you seeing on your sites?
Well, we delivered growth of 100% and nearly 100% in Q3 in the U.S. And the U.S. has been huge for us. You know, it's really, you know, our story kind of mirrors the global story for the industry. When we started the business,
coming off of lower levels, is that fair?
Exactly. You know, coming off of essentially nothing. You know, four or five years ago. When we started this business back in the day, there was no regulated online gambling in the United States. So we left, and we ended up building one of the most important affiliate marketing businesses in the industry, based in Europe, with our biggest office in Ireland and our biggest markets really being the UK and Ireland. And then slow and steady, things started to change in the US. You know, you actually got online casino gaming in New Jersey nearly 10 years ago already. And that was a big deal.
It's huge, but we
didn't really see that, you know, spreading across the United States 10 years ago. And it didn't. It took a number of years before the dam broke. And the dam broke in 2018 when the Supreme Court issued a ruling that invalidated this 1990s era sports betting ban, and that created the climate for what we've seen today with regulated sports betting now rolling out, you know, across the U.S. 20 plus states already with online sports betting, and you know it's a states' rights issue, right? So each individual state is free to kind of do it the way they want, and
is your growth basically just banking on that, like just the growth going across the United States?
Yeah, we had a profitable, high-margin, high-growth business before any of this. Mm-hmm. And then you layer on this incredible growth in the United States, and it, you know, it obviously gets very, very exciting. New York sports betting regulated, you know, over a year ago already. That was the biggest launch to date in the United States. But the real prize that's going to come for the industry here is online casino games, right? Which is, frankly, has a very different margin profile. You know, if you think about sports betting, it's actually quite a low margin product.
What is it typically? I don't know a ton about this industry. I mean, I know generally, but so what's the margin in the sports betting?
Well, if you think about it this way, think about player values. You know, an online sports betting player is worth, you know, probably 1,000 to 2,000 plus, depending on the operator and
like
how
that's
well.
How much they're betting. What do you mean by that?
That's what the lifetime value of the player would be to the online gambling operator that gets them through the door.
Got it.
And you know, we're in the business of referring players to the operators, right? So they pay us something. They don't pay us the entire lifetime value of the player, of course, but it's a very healthy proportion of that. And when you compare sports betting to online casino. Online casino is roughly twice the value, okay? Of course, there's not as many people that play online casino as bet on sports. It's a more kind of niche product where sports betting is quite, you know, mass market. Everybody can wrap their head around sports betting.
But an online casino, the volume, I would assume, like there are people who just play it over and over again.
Absolutely, and you know, that's how the gambling industry works. It's
why the house
part of it is the odds.
Yeah.
Part of it is that house edge, but you know, the other part of it, which people forget, is it's how many times you pull that lever.
Yeah.
If you only pull it once, even if the house edge is very high, it's not such a brilliant business. But if you pull that lever a lot, even if the house edge is very, very low, like it is in slots, mm-hmm. it's a fantastic business.
And make it up on just the frequency.
Yeah.
Where does the macroeconomic issue come into play with that? Because, you know, we keep talking about whether or not we're heading to a recession this year. Is that concerning for the gambling industry?
No.
Do people gamble more when the economy's bad?
It's not that people gamble more. It's that the activity is largely resilient to the economy, even in fairly mature online gambling markets. You know, you look at the UK, which has had regulated online gambling for 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, and even in the UK, it's still growing by 8 or 9% a year. And in the US, the growth is so spectacular that any sort of headwind, which there isn't really, but even if there was a headwind, you probably wouldn't even see it.
You don't feel it.
You wouldn't feel it given the overall growth.
What's the biggest thing in the U.S. that drives people then? Like for the Rihanna concert that some people call the Super Bowl, was that a huge push for you guys? Is it stuff like that?
Absolutely. Player acquisition around sports betting is very event driven. And, you know, there is no bigger event than the sport than the Super Bowl. So, yeah. March Madness is also coming up and a very, very important time of the year for player acquisition.
Charles, how many people these player acquisitions could be you, could be me,
could be us, Carol.
Exactly. How many come in like on the Super Bowl? Can you give us an idea, range?
Well, you know, companies like ours would refer, in any given month, we're referring, you know, over 10,000 new depositing customers.
On average.
I mean, sometimes it's substantially more than that.
Right.
But when you think about our business model, the online gambling operators, they only pay us when we've delivered a customer to their door who has signed up, been verified, has deposited, and has made a bet in a regulated state. So the value proposition we provide to them is crystal clear. And you know, there's a lot of talk these days about...
So you've checked all those boxes before you pass them on.
Well, that's their job. They need to do that.
But
they don't owe us any money until they've cleared all those checks.
Do most of those people clear?
No.
What percent? Is it like half? I'm just curious. Like, is it half?
It's tough to speak to, you know, each step in the process,
okay.
But,
yeah.
One of the issues is a lot of people sign up, but they're not in a regulated state. You know,
right.
if you're in California and you sign up for DraftKings, you can't bet, you know, and that, you know, but if you hop on a plane and you come to New York for whatever reason, then you can. So,
yeah.
A lot of it is really education and historically there's been challenges with payments, you know, especially a couple of years ago, a lot of U.S. banks just did not differentiate between illegal offshore online gambling and actually regulated tax-paying legal onshore gambling.
So you said on average about 10,000 that you're passing on.
It's usually it could be a lot more than that in any given month.
But on Super Bowl, so like at a Super Bowl leading up to the Super Bowl, is it five times that amount? I understand over a lot it's going to even out, but
yeah,
or if it's March Madness,
substantially more. We haven't even reported.
We're Bloomberg. Did they tell you we like numbers?
We love a number.
We
just kidding.
We'll report Q4 on March 23, and we'll give a little color on Q1 at that point as well. I'm sure.
20 seconds left. It sounds very rosy. You seem like growth is coming, especially as regulations ease. 20 seconds. What is the one tricky thing for you in your business?
If there's any headwind at all, it's inflation, right? Talent is expensive, our business runs on people. You know, we do everything
like
we can.
Workers and wages are expensive.
That's not good
for the Fed.
But we've got people all around the world, so we can manage that by hiring in lower cost jurisdictions if necessary.
It's something we've heard from every head of a company.
Yep.
It's all about workers and finding them and then being able to pay them. Charles Gillespie, come back soon. That was really fun. Co-founder, CEO of Gambling.com Group here in our Interactive Brokers studio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/GreenFestival.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. Just about 17 minutes left in today's trading session. Quite a turnaround when it comes to the equity trade. Who'd have thunk? We started with some gains, then we sold off, and now we've bounced, and we're almost at our best levels of the session. You heard Charlie talk about the trade. More economic news, strong labor market, everybody trying to figure out that, you know, the Fed's going to continue to be aggressive. Yields, though, Maddie, have definitely worked off their highs of the session.
Such a flip-floppy day today. I'm excited, though, to have our next guest on to kind of clear up some of the confusion here. We've got Ryan Detrick, Chief Market Strategist at the Registered Investment Advisor Carson Group via Zoom from Charlotte, North Carolina, joining us from there. Ryan, thank you so much for being here to chat with us. First off, you're based in Omaha. You're in Charlotte right now, but we always talk about the Fed. We're here in New York City. What is the perspective on the Fed and the macro issues from the Carson team in Omaha? What do you spend a lot of your time talking about?
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me back. First off, I mean, this, we talk about the same things everyone else, right? I mean, is the Fed really going to be as hawkish as what we're seeing, what yields are saying? Are there really going to be a 50 basis point hike at the next meeting? Maybe another one, you know, 6 weeks later? I'll just put it like this. We've been saying for a while we would avoid a recession this year. We were kind of in a lonely camp when we were saying that. People are coming on. The economy's strong. And I get it. That recent PPI number a little hot. The recent CPI number wasn't perfect. But we look at wage growth, right? Hourly earnings. Hourly earnings have been fairly calm. That ECI number, employment cost index, on the Fed watches very closely, came in lower than expected a couple weeks ago. So things aren't perfect, but we're not so sure the Fed's going to be quite as hawkish as what people say. And again, we think we're going to avoid a recession, and that all in all should be positive in our view.
So when you then, Ryan, take a look technically at the markets, you know, what is it that supports additionally beyond the economic data points? What within the market trade tells you that we're going to avoid a recession?
Yeah, well, I mean, great question there. I'll put it like this. Look at what's leading us, right, this year. It is the more aggressive things. The only things negative year-to-date, Carol, so far this year are like healthcare, staples, utilities, and I guess energy's in there too. But the more defensive things, 1 year ago right now, the war started, by the way, tomorrow, 1 year anniversary. If you look at what was happening before that, it was the exact opposite. The defensive stuff was leading. We are getting some of the more aggressive things. I know people say it's just the junk that's leading. Listen, I'm not so sure I'm buying that. I mean, we're seeing industrials not that far from an all-time high. Industrials, when they're strong, that's good. Now, about the market, just for a second here. You know, the second half of February, we've been talking about this a lot at Carson Group to our advisors. The second half of February is not good. It's usually a hangover month, right? We had a pretty good party the first six weeks of this year with the 11th best start to year ever as of Valentine's Day.
Right.
To see some weakness right now isn't abnormal. Just think about this for the listeners. The previous 10 years that were better than this year was, this is a pretty good year. The rest of the year from Valentine's Day to the end of the year was higher 9 times with some really good performance. So it's kind of that, you know, so goes January, goes the year, a different look at it. But the truth is we're seeing strength across the board from the right groups. We're having a pullback right here in a weak seasonal time frame. And hey, look at that sell at what last point. That 2% drop the other day, it was ugly. Look at the volume. It was really light, right around the 3-day weekend. Some of us had a 4-day weekend. That's not too bad to see light volume on a sell-off, and that's what we've seen the past couple days.
Well, and are you thinking from a technical perspective that we're going to see that traditional idea of the bad performers of 2022 becoming the good performers of 2023?
Yeah, we're not so sure there. Cyclical value did fairly well last year, and I know energy was the big winner. I get it, into some of the defensive things. But since the October lows, cyclical value has done well. You know, I guess the big question is, what do you think of tech, and what do you think of communication services, right? Those were the big losers last year. We're still even weight those. I just had a meeting before I jumped over here talking about our sector allocations, and we're sticking with the cyclical value names, your industrials, financials, materials. We're more even weight as it comes to tech and communication services. But just the fact that they're going higher finally, I don't think that's a bad thing. Look around the globe. My goodness. I mean, some European ETFs are literally making all-time highs earlier this week. So we're seeing more participation broadly across the globe, wildly different than 12 months ago right now.
But volume has been pretty weak over the last month or so, Ryan. We've certainly seen that pull back. So there's one thing to consider. The other thing is our Elena Popina had a great story, basically how the S&P 500 took a ride to nowhere during earnings season. So we're talking about from JP Morgan to Walmart. But I think it's really important. She says, You know, corporate earnings have served as the cornerstone to the stock market's gains during much of the last decade. In fact, some 90% of the S&P 500's gains in the decade through 2022 have occurred when America's largest firms posted their scorecards. So, you know, to not see that, how does that factor in?
Oh, I mean, I'm not overly concerned there, Carol. We had a 17% rally off the October lows, you know, into middle of this month. And I'll tell you, you know, I think it's just more consolidation. And yeah, earnings season, let's be honest, earnings season wasn't very good. I mean, some companies had good things to say. Overall, it wasn't very good. And just to say, hey, stocks were flat after the big bounce we had into earnings season, that's something we're looking at. Last comment here, and I know everybody talks about this, but the dollar was historically strong last year, still playing, you know, still a headwind for a lot of multinational companies. We think the dollar is going to weaken this year. The Fed did its thing. A lot of other central banks are more aggressive. A weak dollar should be more of a tailwind to global earnings as we reach the second half of this year. And we think earnings come in a little bit better than most people expect this year, again, as we can avoid a recession thanks to that consumer, which is still pretty strong.
So you're a bull.
Yeah, we are a bull. We think the S&P will gain between 12 and 15% this year. We said that back in December. We said we'd avoid a recession back in December. And we like small caps a lot. We didn't talk about that one. One final comment there. We like small caps. They've been leading. Small caps did not make new lows back in October from the June lows. That was a sign from the market that something was going on. Nobody knows what exactly, but small cap leadership's a good thing. And we still like small caps. And if you don't avoid a recession, that's a place you want to be.
We've been talking about small caps a lot this year.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. The Russell 2000 has been popping up quite a bit for us. Ryan, do we have maybe 10 seconds for you? Do you see disinflation happening in what you look at?
Yeah, we do. We see, I mean, it seems a lot of people. We see rents going down a lot faster. We see used cars going down a lot faster. Those are bigger parts to core CPI than they were this time a month ago. And the second half of this year, disinflation should take place.
All right. We shall see. Ryan Dietrich, thank you so much. Good to check in with you once again. Chief Market Strategist over at the Carson Group, joining us via Zoom from Charlotte, North Carolina.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.